Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
The following is a special presentation of the Mungadas St. Louis Honda and Mitsubishi Sports Open Line.
Welcome to Sports and More with Mike Claiborne. Sponsored by the world-famous Fast Eddie's Bon Air on America's Sports Voice, KMOX.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Sports and More. I'm Mike Claiborne, and our special guest this evening is a gentleman who played in the National Hockey League, but you know him more as the guy who says holy jumping, and we're going to find out where that came from in just a bit. He is Darren Pang of the St. Louis Blues broadcast team, and it's always good to talk to him, but Panger, as long as we've known each other, we've never had a chance to actually have a sit-down like this, and I'm looking forward to it.
Well, I think that every time we get together, Mike, it's a great time for a sit-down and talk, and I've always enjoyed talking hockey with you, even when I wasn't in St. Louis, when I was in the old ESPN days. So I know how much you love the game, and I'm looking forward to this opportunity to chat here.
Well, let's have some fun. Let's go back to your childhood and your junior days. You know, you played for the Ottawa 67s, which is, for people who are not from the Canadian territory of understanding how important junior hockey is, it's a big deal. And with the 67s being, what, over 50 years old, one of the last legitimate junior teams, they turned out so many good players over the years. And I think when you look at guys like Brian Kilray, who went in the Hockey Hall of Fame, the pedigree of an Ottawa 67er is something that people stand up and salute to in a lot of cases.
Well, yeah, I'm glad you brought up Ottawa because, you know, growing up in this small town just west of Ottawa called Nepean, I grew up watching the Ottawa 67s. They were our NHL team. Those were my heroes. If I could ever play for that team growing up, I thought, boy, that would be the ultimate because the Toronto Maple Leafs are 4 hours to the west, and then the Montreal Canadiens are an hour and 45 minutes right to the east in Quebec. And so we either grew up Montreal Canadiens fans or Toronto Maple Leaf fans. It was quite simple. I was a Montreal Canadiens fan, but before that, I was a Ottawa 67s fan. Doug Wilson, who has become a longtime friend, amazingly enough, Bobby Smith and Jimmy Fox, Steve Payne, players like that. I mean, I just couldn't wait to go on a Friday night and watch them play.
Well, let's talk about how you found yourself as a goaltender. I mean, let's face it, you're not the Ken Dryden of hockey as far as height is concerned. How did you end up being a goaltender? And who were some of the people you admired from a distance growing up?
Well, number one, my father, Jerry, who is still alive, 82 years old and living in Fernie, British Columbia. In fact, he just stopped 2 years ago as a goalie coach for a junior B team there in a small town of Fernie, believe it or not. He's still active and on skates or just was. And so he was a large influence in me becoming a goaltender. In fact, I was a forward, you know, at the age of like 5, 6, and 7 and loved playing forward. I scored a lot of goals. I was a forward in lacrosse. I played competitively there and I was always a goal scorer or playmaker. And I didn't like the prospects of being a goalie, to be quite honest with you, but we needed a goalie. My dad said, why don't you give it a try? My dad had played goal in high school. He was a pretty accomplished goalie. And as it turns out, I guess I was pretty good in net, and I was fast, even though I was very small. I could catch pucks, and so I caught a lot of pucks. And my dad's like, you know, you should really continue this on. And I didn't really want to, but what I did to compromise was because I was on a travel team already at the age of 6, 7, and 8 as the goalie. There was a rule that you couldn't play as a forward in a similar league. So. Kind of a dumb thing, isn't it? You're trying to eliminate a guy that likes to be a forward.
Exactly.
So I played in the outdoor league. It was called the Bayshore Outdoor Hockey League. And so I got to continue being a forward playing outdoor hockey. But then, you know, now my my kind of my path was becoming set as a travel competitive goaltender in Ottawa. So I stayed with it, and you know, later on, my dad said that I probably wouldn't have stood a chance being my height, you know, playing forward. And he thought I had the best chance of being a goaltender with how quick I was. So that's how it went. But Claves, anytime I had a chance to put on forward skates and put on, get my sticks ready and play hockey, whether it be street hockey or outdoor hockey, I always did it. And boy, I love it. Even to this day, I love watching forwards that can make a play, playmakers that can see the ice. And I've always been probably more intrigued with that part of the game than I had been with the goaltending part of the game.
So you had a choice to be either Marcel Dion or Tiny Thompson, so you went the Thompson route.
Well, it's funny to say Tiny Thompson, because there was actually, believe it or not, there was a goalie smaller than he was, and his name was Roy Shrimp Waters, W-O-R-T-E-R-S.
Wow.
I've done some research on this fella, and he's the smallest goalie to ever play. He was 5'3" and a half and 132 pounds, I believe. And when I dived through all the notes and stats of all these goalies, besides the fact that I lied like crazy to get to 5'5", 150 pounds, I was really I'm 5'4 and a half, and I played in the NHL at 135. So I would have become the second smallest goaltender to have ever played. And Roy Shrimp Waters the first. And I think Tiny Thompson had me by an inch and a half anyway. But isn't that something? I mean, I love Wayne Gretzky. I kept a scrapbook of Wayne when he played in the Quebec Pee Wee Tournament. I had played in it a couple of years later. I started a scrapbook. I started following this kid from Brantford. I watched him play junior hockey for the Sioux. And every time he came to Ottawa and played against Bobby Smith and Jimmy Fox and all these guys with the 67s, I never missed one of those games. And I got his autograph when he was 16. So I kind of, as a player, I tried to emulate the way Wayne played in street hockey, you know, on the ice. And I think a lot of people did, though. And so that would be the one player that I would I couldn't wait to watch and try to emulate when I played outdoor hockey or whatever.
So when you bought into being a goalie, who did you try and emulate? Who was a goaltender that you paid attention to? Because you didn't have many guys you could compare yourself to as far as your stature was concerned.
No, when I was playing Tier 2, which is just the Junior A league, before you make a decision if you're drafted Major Junior A, most kids play Tier 2, which would be like, it'd be a little bit higher than what the St. Louis, you know, the Bandits were, when John Cooper and Jeff Brown were coaching and Pat Maroon played for that team. It's a little higher, more like almost the USHL. Anyway, you make a decision whether you're going to go play Major Junior A or you're going to get a scholarship. So when I was at that age, I was an underage at 16, Don Beaupre was playing for the Sudbury Wolves. And then Don Beaupre at 19, you know, he made it with the Minnesota North Stars, which was really kind of stunning. And he had a great run in 1980 or 81. And so as I got a little bit older, I really liked Don Beaupre and the way he played. But when I was younger, it would be Rogie Vachon. When he played for the Los Angeles Kings,
broke in with the Canadians, you know, and went to LA.
Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly. He was so, he had two pad stack and poke check and had a great glove. And you know, he played very small, but he was really successful. So I guess he would be the one guy that when I went to bed at night and I had a poster on my wall, it would be Rogie Vachon. I dreamed one day that I could maybe be Rogie Vachon at some point.
Well, that wasn't a bad goaltender. I mean, you know, when he was in L.A., he didn't get much help in front of him, so he had to find a way to be pretty good most nights in the week. And, you know, that change from the Canadians and playing in front behind those great players and then going out to L.A., and yeah, it was a shooting gallery out there at that point. But he made himself into a really good goaltender. Darren Pang is our guest. We're going to take a break. We'll come back with more here on KMOX after this.
This is a special presentation of the Mungadas St. Louis Honda and Mitsubishi Sports Open Line.
Welcome back to Sports and More, sponsored by the world-famous Fast Eddie's Bonaire. Once again, Mike Claiborne on KMOX.
As we continue with Darren Pang of the St. Louis Blues broadcast team, Fox Sports Midwest, and you can see him on the on so many channels around the world. I mean, you're big in Canada. You're still a rock star up there. We're talking about his career and things that really started to develop for you when you went to Chicago and you got a chance to play there. And talk a little bit about that situation, because not only did you play with some a pretty rugged bunch, guys like Glenn Cochran, and I think Bob Basson was there as well, and
yeah.
Dave Mance, and who can forget him, and Warren Reichel. They had some rough, tough customers, but you also had, I'm not sure if it was an opportunity, but you did play for Mike Keenan at one point.
I did. It was my second year of being in the NHL in 1988-89. Mike Keenan took over for Bob Murdoch, and I thought things started out really well with Mike. We were in Montreal. I was at the NHL All-Rookie Team banquet, and I'd been named to the All-Rookie Team, and I thought I had a good start to the NHL career. Mike and I met, and he shook my hand, and weeks later I got this beautiful letter from him that, talking about how he looks forward to working with me. And then we got to training camp, and I don't know, something changed. I think he was out to prove that I wasn't going to be the goaltender for him. And he kept talking to any media type that he could talk to, Mike, about, Ron Hextall types and big goalies and, all this. So the writing was on the wall that wasn't going to be a good turn for me. I tried my best. I worked hard at it. I got hurt in January. But I'll say this about Mike, and as years have gone on, I don't want to sound like a bitter former player that just didn't work out, because I'm not that way. But I love the game of hockey, and I love going to the rink. And I will tell you this, and I've told Mike this. I said, you're the only guy that I've ever played for that sucked the life out of me. And, I know when I said it to him, I know that those types of things, as you get older, I'm sure kind of bother him in the way he dealt with some people. But I always felt like, you're the coach. You're a guy that you should be doing something better to get more out of your players instead of sucking the life out of them and getting less out of them. And I was always disappointed by that for such an accomplished coach. And so as it turns out, my career did end up with a knee injury, a hamstring injury, a knee injury. I went down to the minors and tried to rehab it. And I played with Bobby Basson and Warren Reichel and Mike Eagles, a really good hockey team. Daryl Sutter was the coach, and we won a Turner Cup. And then I tore my knee again playing tennis, just getting ready for camp. So my career was over with. I did often say, though, Mike, that, and I think a lot of players that have gone through the wrath of a Mike Keenan, I think as they get older, they look back, and I would have liked another piece of that. I would have liked to have done it again. And I never backed down from Mike, not once. I threw a mask at him on the bench. I called him a quitter on the bench. I challenged him in the locker room, not to fight, but I challenged him. And it showed a good bit of character from me and other players that had done it. But at the end of the day, I would have liked another run with a clean slate and seen how that would have gone. Because I know guys that played with him in St. Louis, Curtis Joseph and I had the same conversation. How can you take somebody that's vital to your team and a passionate person and have a lot of heart and for whatever reason want to suck that out of them and take them away from it? I never did understand that, to be quite honest with you. I never thought that was very good coaching.
Well, I think you're in a pretty big club when it comes to Mike Keenan. I don't think there are very many people who understood him. Except, he had a handful of guys, whether it was Adam Creighton and players, wherever he went, he'd find Brian Noonan was another guy that he would take wherever he went. And they were kind of the conduits, I felt. Yeah, Greg Gilbert was another. I thought they were the conduit to the rest of the team on how Mike was. A very complex individual who I think never understood when to put the brakes on, because he tried to treat everybody the same, and you can't do that. And I think he felt like, I'm going to tear him down and then build him up. But everybody doesn't respond that way. And he's had a lot of talent over the years. And the fact that he only won one cup, I think, says a lot about the fact that he wasn't as good as maybe he thought he was, but he was so intriguing, people continued to give him jobs. And that was the amazing part about him.
Yeah, I think that's a very fair evaluation. I think that I think there are some aspects of his coaching that was brilliant. I still wonder to this day when I watch a hockey team struggle during a game, you know, Mike wouldn't put up with that for a large part of it. And he might throw a right winger, you know, on the top line for two shifts to say, let's go bang some people around or, you know, just do something to change things up. And then there were moments where he flat out quit on teams and got quiet and tried to prove a point that way. So it was. I'll go back to something you said about building, you know, tearing people down and building them up. And I guess my feeling on that is if you do your research on your players, you would know which players, you know, had to really climb a hard mountain to get there. And to get beat up again is a fruitless endeavor for me. And so anyway, I that's what I mean by I would have liked another run at it, because I think I probably could have been one of those players that came back in a couple of years and been a goaltender for Mike and been able to balance out the angst from the players and maybe, you know, step into that role, just much like the Greg Gilberts, the Trent Yannis, you mentioned them all, I think, Adam Crane's, Glenn Anderson went back to the New York Rangers. I mean, he'd forever go back to the well, because those players did understand what he was all about. But I agree with you on the other part, too. I think he underachieved. I think there was way more in the tank for him to only win one Stanley Cup with the teams he had. I think he probably loses a little bit of sleep at night knowing that he probably could have done a better job.
Well, when you think about the teams that he had just in St. Louis alone, they were Stanley Cup contenders. I mean, you know, he and Curtis Joseph were never on the same page, and that was unfortunate because Curtis Joseph is probably the best goalie that's not in the Hall of Fame. And when you think about it, and I know some will say, well, he couldn't get out of the first round, but, you know, he got some teams to the playoffs and got them at least to the first round. So I think that he had a lot of shortcomings, and maybe as he looks back at his career, he probably regrets a few things as well. Well, a couple of things I want to run by you with regard to your career, though. Okay, the injury bug strikes and you're done. I mean, you tried to come back. What was next for you? Because a guy in your situation at a young age and your career is over, what did you do next?
So September of 1990, I went to camp. I couldn't pass the physical with my left knee again. And I sat up in the stands for training camp, and I met with Bob Pulford, the GM, and I met with Lisa Seltzer, was a producer and director. You've probably run into her along the way, longtime TV producer, and she was a big help for me. And I wasn't sure exactly what to do, but I was really thinking that broadcasting was going to be my next step, because the year before, while I was rehabbing my ACL, Lisa Seltzer and the Blackhawks allowed me to do CCHA hockey. And so on Sports Vision or Sports Channel, I can't remember if they'd switched yet. And so I began that part of it. I remember doing a live game, UIC Flames against Bowling Green. And the players on Bowling Green, Nelson Emerson and Rob Blake, were the headliners. And I remember finishing that open, and my mouth was a little bit dry, and I was a little bit nervous, but I got it all out. And I remember thinking after that game, boy, I really like this. And at the same time, I was helping out with the UIC Flames goaltenders as well. So I was starting to like being a coach. So I kind of had a decision to make. But in the meantime, I ran the Blackhawks hotline called, it was 1-800-HAWK-TALK. And so I did that. I did the pregame show on WBBM News Radio 78 between periods and the postgame show. And I started doing a weekly show as well on the TV side. And, you know, that did evolve into ESPN in 1993 when ESPN2 was launched. And then from that point on, I maintained a kind of more of a national presence and let go of any duties in Chicago. And I worked there for 14 years. So it was, even at that point, though, I still dabbled in some coaching. Dave Poulin was coaching the Notre Dame Fighting Irish hockey team, and he called me and asked if I would be the goalie coach. And so three times a month, I went to Notre Dame, and I helped him out for 3 years. And I really liked it again. I really liked it, and I really wanted to get into that aspect of hockey. But as it turns out, my broadcasting career just kept flying, and I couldn't take a step back to get into the coaching aspect of it. So I stayed where I was, and that's exactly what happened. I got a lot of help and a lot of guidance. I had a GM that I'm very thankful that Bob Pulford pulled me aside and said, "You'll likely not play in the NHL again. You proved people wrong. You did a great job, but it's time to take the next step. And I'm here to tell you that you should get into broadcasting." Without a general manager and a friend like that, I'm not sure if I would have taken that step, because I was a little afraid, to be quite honest with you.
Well, you know, I think a lot of guys, when they see their career, when they think they can come back and they chase that dream, they want one more shot, and then 3 or 4 years later, somebody else has the job you should have had as a broadcaster or something else within a front office. And, you know, there's always another guy that's going to be available, so you have to jump at the opportunity. And I, for one, am glad that you did. We're going to take another break. We're going to come back. Darren Pang is our guest. This is Sports and More. I'm Mike Claiborne. Back after this.
This is a special presentation of the Mungadas St. Louis Honda and Mitsubishi Sports Open Line.
Welcome back to Sports and More, sponsored by the world-famous Fast Eddie's Bonaire. Once again, Mike Claiborne on KMOX.
Welcome back, everybody. We continue with Darren Pang. And Darren Pang has been an outstanding broadcaster. He's been involved in not only just the St. Louis Blues, but he was in Arizona. He's been in with ESPN. He's huge in Canada. And he's had a chance to cover so many events. But I want to ask you about goaltending for a bit. If you could create the perfect goalie as far as skating ability, puck handling, glove hand, stick side hand, pads, great lower body, and being upright to make saves, give me something from the goalies you've seen. Maybe you played against them. Maybe they were people you admire. Give me the perfect goalie.
The perfect goaltender, okay. Mental strength and never letting the game get away from them. Grant Fuhr. I never cared about the score with Grant Fuhr. I always looked at the save that he made when the game was still on the line. And I think he's the best at that. Hockey mind and sense. I would go with Marty Brodeur. I think his, he had an uncanny ability to read the play. Was never predictable. Could give you a poke check, two pad slide, or just stay on his feet and actually lure you into something that wasn't even there. I'd say for sheer competitiveness, one-on-one game seven, I would take Dominik Hasek. It was just too long of a time that he won games 1-0, and it just seemed like you just never score on him. So the never give up and that kind of competitive drive. I'll throw something at you that I'm just making them up as I go along. Swagger. I think the goalie that had the best swagger would probably be Patrick Waugh. I mean, he just had that ability to deflect any faults, criticism, and would show up in a locker room, and like he did in 96 when the Rats were coming on the ice, and he told his team there'll be no more Rats, and he shut them out the rest of that game, and then he shut them out in the last game and won it. So that would probably be my modern day grouping. And I think that's a pretty good group. And I was able to play against Grant. I played against Patrick Waugh. I retired the same year that Dominik Hasek came over from then Czechoslovakia. And obviously I've gotten to know Marty Brodeur really, really well. And I covered many Stanley Cup final when he was there, and I got to know him then, but I know him better now. And I'm such a big fan of him as a player and just as a person. I think he's just a great guy.
Well, I would agree with you on Brodeur. I think Brodeur was the best athlete of any of the goalies I've seen. And I think from a mental toughness, and I'm going back maybe a few years before that, Glenn Hall would be my guy if I had the one game and the toughness aspect. And, you know, he's got a record that'll never be broken, 502 consecutive games. And I'll tell you another guy with respect to anticipation, Ken Dryden. You know, he found a way to make saves, because he was the first really big goalie but he was able to stay on the skates more than a lot of guys would. But he had great anticipation. But, I mean, those guys you threw on the board, it'd be hard to score against those guys as well. But, you know, when you look at the game today, I'm not sure. I think equipment has been a better difference maker for goalies than the goalie themselves.
Yeah, it's starting to come back to the athletic goalie again, which I'm really happy about. I think that blocking style of, and I'll use a goalie coach that, as successful as he was, I think he did hurt the position, and that's Francois Lair. I mean, he's just a brilliant goalie coach. While I was doing Stanley Cup Finals, I would order books and I'd have them sent to my room, like to my hotel, and try to read up more about him. And I finally pulled him aside one time and I said, Francois, I said, I wouldn't be your kind of goalie, huh? And he goes, no, Darren, you probably wouldn't. And I said, too small, huh? Too athletic. And he goes, yes. And I said, I've read two books now, and I don't understand a lot of it. But so it took us, you know, a certain ability, like Giguere had that ability, and Patty Waugh at the end had the ability to understand what he was all about. But I think right now they've streamlined the pants better. The blocker can't get any smaller. Honestly, the catching glove, maybe a bit of the cheater can get taken out, but these goalies are now, they're the size of the defenseman that I played with, and the defensemen are the size of the goalies that I played with. So it's all changed, and I think we are getting athleticism back into the game, and I'm really thankful for that. We saw a save by Jordan Binnington recently against David Backes where he had to move from his right to his left, do the splits, get his glove up. And I believe that the goalies are being tested more and more now with east-west plays, dot-to-dot plays, and that's creating less equipment making saves and more of the goaltender being able to move across and be reactionary like we're seeing a little bit more of.
Darren Pang is our guest, and as we talk goaltending, one of the things that bugs me to no end, and I love him because he's my favorite goalie, was Glenn Hall created the butterfly, and he went down a lot, but he had the ability to get back up. I see so many goalies that go down and stay down, and now shooters now know, hey, look, go top shelf. And we see so many of these highlight goals of guys going top shelf because the goalie goes down, he leans forward, he gives away the top part of the net. And this is one of the things I kind of have come to appreciate with Jordan Binnington. He stays on his skates a lot longer and is a little bit more comfortable going side to side, as you mentioned, on his skates compared to being on his pads.
Yeah, I'd rather have goalies on their edges. I still believe that I could go on the ice and utilize the same drills that I, you know, worked at forever. And not be successful at it. I know I could improve a lot of goaltenders, and holding your play on your edges, making sure that you post up on your edges instead of push and slide, the net's only 6x4. You don't have to go beyond where the post is. You don't have to go beyond where the crease is. So half your body's, on the other side of the post. It's a ridiculous waste of movement. So I agree with you. I think I use the term patient on your edges, and I think you have to stay on them for as long as you possibly can. These shooters are too good. Jordan Binnington's a good example. He's only 6'1". He's a very skinny kid, but I think he plays a big position. I think he looks bigger in that net. I think his hand position's really good where they're out in front of him. They're a little more free. He's able to catch pucks, use his blocker, and shooters think they've got more space, but I think it's the angles that he holds his hands that makes him look a lot bigger than what he actually is. And, UC Saros, some of the smaller goalies out in the league, even Henrik Lundqvist is only 6 feet tall, but he sure plays like he's bigger than that.
Plays bigger than that, yeah.
Equipment looks bigger than that.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Hey, Darren Pang is our guest. We're going to come back with our final segment. We're talking hockey. We're talking a lot of things, so stick around. We'll be back after this.
This is a special presentation of the Mungadas St. Louis Honda and Mitsubishi Sports Open Line.
Welcome back to Sports and More, sponsored by the world-famous Fast Eddie's Bonaire. Once again, Mike Claiborne on KMOX.
As we wind up things with Darren Pang, our final segment, all right, I mentioned this at the beginning, holy jumping. I mean, everybody's got some sort of term they like to use, something they love to talk about, and people remember them for it. Where do we get holy jumping from?
Well, when I'm starting my broadcasting career, I've always had a great deal of energy going to the rink, and my calls on a good player, they're I'm excitable, and I've always been that way. And I was at the Meadowlands in New Jersey. Steve Levy was my play-by-play partner, and the Devils had just recalled this small skilled player named Steve Sullivan, and Steve went on to play over 1,000 games in the NHL. But when I was in the locker room talking to their players and talking to their coaches, and I ended up kind of sitting with Steve for quite a long time. He's an avid golfer. We had that in common. He's a small guy. I had these knit caps that I was given out through a company called, it was kind of a little guy with hands or something, little guy with gumption, or it was something kind of like that theme. And I'm thinking to myself, this guy, he's right on the mark. This is exactly the kind of player I'm talking about, a little guy with good hands and all kinds of stuff. So the game starts, and he hasn't done anything. And remember, it was the day of more holding and grabbing and bigger players. And every time he got the puck, he kind of coughed it up. And I was getting disappointed, to be honest with you. I was in the broadcast booth, and I'm pumping him up, but I'm getting disappointed. Next thing you know, he gets this puck, and he's on the right side, and he's a right-hand shot, and he goes one way, fakes it, pulls it back, and now he's in the middle of the ice. And again, he looks like he's going to go to the right, and he slides right between the defenseman's legs. I think it was Yanni Nienema. And then he goes in on the goalie, and he gives him an old, you know, the right back, right forehand, fakes him backhand under the bar, off the crossbar, in the net. And I, before Steve Levy could, you know, say he shoots, he scores, I literally nearly jumped out of the seat, and I said, holy jumping! What? You know, and I was just so excited about this play because I'd been so disappointed with Steve's play before. And after the game, Steve Levy said to me, he goes, you know what? He says, you might have to bottle that one up. That was unbelievable. He goes, don't use it all the time, but when something excites you like that excited you, he says, that was a lot of fun for me. So when a play-by-play guy says that, you know, because I railroaded him. I mean, I did what analysts are not supposed to do, which I do way too often, get too excited over a goal. But that's where it came from. And there was a Steve Sullivan call, probably 1996 or 97.
Hey, you know, for you, in your career, you were part of the last great heyday era of wide open goal scorers and just fire wagon hockey. Who were some of the guys that you had the paperwork on where you could stymie them? And who were some guys when you saw them coming down the boards and you just said, uh-oh, this may not end well?
I probably should not start with the first part because I didn't really stymie too many guys. I'll go with the second part because I kept a book on shooters. In fact, when I injured my hamstring, Mike Kanin pulled me aside and said, I want you to write a book on the shooters in the NHL. So I said, well, Mike, I'll do it on the Norris division. And so I had the five tab book, which I still have to this day. We'll have to go over it one time and I'll show you. And I had every shooter, their curve of their stick, the color of their tape, the make of their stick, set plays. I drew them all up, and I had this whole explanation on it. And Mike took that book and he kept it for weeks. So I mean, until I finally said, "Hey, Mike, I want that book back." You know. but anyway, Brett Hull. I mean, I felt like when we played in the American Hockey League against each other, I stopped him several times, but he scored 50 that year, and I only played him twice. When we got to the NHL, and he teamed up with Adam Oates. And even before that, it was a little scary. Every time I turned around, it was either in the net or it was off the post and in the net. So Hully was he was trouble for me.
And you kept Tony Hercus in the league for a while too.
Tony Hercus scored 4 goals on me in a playoff game. That was unbelievable. I think that's still a Blues rookie record. It'll probably last forever.
I think
forever.
You're right.
And I was the goalie that. See, I'm always trying to help out the St. Louis Blues. See that? The other Yzerman in Detroit was tough, but so was like Gerard Gallant was tough because Steve was the playmaking centerman. Like when I played against Bernie Federko, Bernie wasn't the tougher one. It was going to be Brian Sutter. Like, where's the winger? When you got a playmaking centerman, you got to remember that you're always worried about the winger because that's what great playmakers are. And that's what Bernie was. And that's what Yzerman was. And Gretzky to Curry. And then Oates to Hull. So that was tough for me. Dino Ciccarelli, another guy. I mean, always in front of the net, great hands, knock pucks out of midair like it was nothing. And so he was awfully tough as well. So they, let's face it, that era of players, I liked it. It was wide open. There was more 2-on-1s and 3-on-1s and 3-on-2s. You had a lot of rush chances. You had a lot of good scoring chances. And those guys obviously, you know, made goalies like me pay a pretty big premium.
Well, you weren't the only goalie. There was a lot of guys that got left behind. It was such a up and down brand, and I kind of miss it. The physical play was there as well, but everybody could shoot the puck and everybody had the ability to score. But although this era, because we don't have as many tough guys that fight or anything, that fourth line, you see a little bit more skill on it than what you used to. So you, in this day and age, you even have to respect those guys a little bit more, I would think.
Oh, there's no question. The fourth liners of today are so much more skilled than what we faced. I mean, we had plumbers and we knew what their job was, but you know, they didn't often get the puck, you know, on their stick in the offensive zone on a 2-on-1 break. And, like nowadays, I mean, I look at Mackenzie McEachran or Ivan Barbashev or, you know, Sandy Blais happens to be a fourth liner right now. These guys can all make plays. They can all shoot it. They can go forehand, backhand and make you look silly in a hurry. So, the one thing of today is you can't take a breather like maybe we could in our time. There's no breathing time. You're going to get pretty good chances, and if you don't pay attention, you may very well be embarrassed on a play.
Hey, to talk a little bit about the broadcasting for a minute. I mentioned you've done a lot. You've had a lot of fun. You've been on some great calls and some great games, and you've worked with a lot of people. Who are some of the people that you learned from that's made you a better broadcaster?
Well, John Davidson was my mentor. The aforementioned Lisa Seltzer, when I first got into broadcasting, the New York Rangers came into Chicago, and so let's say that's 1990 and 91, and she just introduced me to John, and as we walked away, she said, if he ever pulls out, he always had this, the yellow
notepad
with the lines in it, but he never had it in a notepad. He always had the paper folded up in some mysterious way that I could never figure out. And he had all these layers, and he'd write something down. And I remember at one point he asked me how everything was going in Chicago, or was there anything that I'd noticed or picked up. And so I mentioned to him that, yeah, I thought something interesting. Chris Chelios actually uses Guy Lafleur's pattern, the same pattern. Well, sure enough, he pulled out that yellow piece of paper, and he's got three or four layers of it, and he starts writing it down, and he says, big boy, that's a good nugget. And the way he said it, I'm like, wow, that's exactly what Lisa said. If he pulls out, if he writes down something I said, I've got a good little nugget going for him. And over the years, we got to work two Olympics, Nagano in 98 for CBS. I was a sideline reporter. I was actually between the benches before that was in vogue. And then in 2002, I was also between the benches in Salt Lake City for NBC. So we got to work that, and we got to work a lot of final games, even though he was a main analyst in the chair. I was always the sideline goalie reporter, and we played a lot of golf together, and we just got to know each other real well. And I think that's what, you know, that's what kind of began the process of me becoming a St. Louis Blue broadcaster. It was really because of John Davidson, you know, pushing that and opening that door for me personally. So I'm forever grateful. But Steve Levy is another one that I always learned from. He was always a great question asker. He always could put something efficiently into a question. So I still rely on him to this day. Dave Strader was obviously a dear friend of mine that passed away, and I learned a lot from him.
Wonderful
as well.
Person.
So, a lot of guys along the way, boy, I tell you. And then there's a lot of producers, as you know, Mike. They give you good guidance and make sure you're on the right path. And I certainly wouldn't be here without all the help of them. But I think JD was the one that I looked up to the very most.
Well, there you have it, folks. Darren Pang, he has become a fixture in St. Louis, and certainly his broadcasting career is one that has become a very successful one. He's one of the most respected people in the game, and we're glad to have him in St. Louis. More importantly, we're glad to have him on Sports and More here on KMOX. So for Darren Pang, I'm Mike Claiborne. We thank you for listening. Had a lot of fun with him, and hopefully you had as much as we did. And we'll look forward to talking to you again for another installment of Sports and More here on Your Voice for the St. Louis Blues and St. Louis Cardinals, KMOX.
Oh, such a clutch pickup, Dave.
I know, right? I was worried we'd bring back the same team.
Oh, no, I meant those blackout motorized shades. MVP of the room.
Blinds.com made it crazy affordable to replace our old blinds.
Hard to install?
No, it's easy. Even you could do it.
Nice.
I installed these and then got some for my mom, too.
What, you fly across the country to do the install?
Nope. Blinds.com can do it all. All she had to do was pick what she wanted. She talked to a design consultant for free and scheduled a professional measure and install.
Look at you, a Hall of Fame son.
Oh, I just picked the winning team. They're the number one online retailer of custom window coverings in the world.
Oh, Blinds.com is the GOAT.
The GOAT.
He shoots. He scores.
Go to Blinds.com for up to 40% off and a 100% satisfaction guarantee. Go right now for up to 40% off at Blinds.com. Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.